Hello from Vancouver. I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome. I just got off the Skype phone with Joan Key to talk about her really beautiful new book, Contemporary Korean Art, Tansequa and the Urgency of Method. This came out in 2013 with the University of Minnesota Press. Now, this is not only a beautiful book, it's just a gorgeous object. It's also an exceptionally creative and very thoughtfully constructed, written and conceptualized study of a fascinating but very little studied or understudied movement of contemporary art in Korea. So you'll hear a lot about this over the course of the interview, and I'll let you get to that soon. But just broadly speaking, this is a book that's not just about Korean artists, and it's not just about art in Korea by artists who are identifying as Korean. It's also a book about how people, how artists have materialized interests and conceptions of authorship and viewership, of time, of space, of sort of practice and materiality. And so it's a book that speaks much more broadly than simply to or only to, or even at all to, an area studies specific audience. So this is a book for you, not only if you're interested in modern Korea, contemporary Korea, but also if you're simply just interested in work with things and objects, contemporary art, the history of artists and painting and material studies. It's also very, very interestingly and carefully engaged with the political framing and political context in which these practices are taking place. So it's a fascinating study. Again, it's a beautiful book and a beautiful study, and I really enjoy talking with Joan about it. So I hope you do too, and I hope you have a chance to take a look at the book and ideally to read it. Enjoy, and thanks for joining us. I'm here today to talk with Joan Key about her recent book, Contemporary Korean Art, Tansequa and the Urgency of Method. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Joan. Congratulations on a gorgeous and really fascinating book. And thanks very much for negotiating the time difference between London and Vancouver and being here to talk with me today. I'm really excited.
Well, likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Joan, could you start us off by saying really just a little bit about how you came to work on the history of modern Korean art?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. So to get to, in some ways, it's really a question about how is it that, say, someone like me would even get to study contemporary Asian art? Because, say, by the time I graduated from university in the late 1990s, it wasn't really considered a legitimate subfield within art history. So a particular very well-known curator at a very well-known institution in New York, who, of course, shall remain nameless, once told me, why don't you study real Asian art? Oh. So the question, thereby implying that somehow art essentially made after the 20th century was not considered a valid field of study, that somehow it was necessarily derivative of what had taken place previously. And this is not this is true not only for, say, Korean art, but really for anyone working in what might be called Asian art generally. So a lot of sort of the difficulty was even trying to find a graduate program that would allow for the study of this kind of material, which actually really didn't take place until well into the first years of the 21st century, really. And this is something that's true not only for myself, but many of my peers who also work in this general field of modern Asian art. But in terms of, say, Korean art, it's even more of a hard sell, as one can imagine, again, because Korea is not as prominent as some of its colleagues, or sorry, its counterparts in the general framework of area studies. So we think of China, Japan, India, now Korea, many countries in Southeast Asia. These areas are still, people who work in these areas still have quite an uproad, sort of an uphill battle when it comes to figuring out what their place is going to be, not only in the regional studies framework, but also the humanities in general.
So the book that we're talking about today is about, as the title indicates, Tansequa, which was an important art movement in the history of contemporary art in Korea. And you talk, it's not only a beautiful book just as an object, but it's also a book that really gets inside, opens up, and explores this concept. Now, Tansequa is known, as you tell us early in the book, as Korean monochrome painting. And the book also considers what it means and what it has meant to think and write and talk about something called, something like, something conceptualized as Korean painting. So it's about this movement, but it's also about much, much, much more than simply a given body of work. So how did you come to work on this particular focus for the book, and how did you come to decide to shape the book into this kind of structured object?
Okay, so essentially that's several questions in one. The first question is, why Tansequa? The simple answer is that because I think it's great work. That's really what it boils down to. And this is something that for me informs everything I do, is that it's not necessarily where the artist is from or where the artwork happens to be situated. If it's great, if it's compelling, if the direct visual experience has something interesting to say to a larger audience, that's what I'm going to work on. Now, in terms of, say, the structure of the book, that was quite a challenge, because one of the real issues in thinking about, say, not just Korean art, but non-Western modern arts generally, is this overwhelming need to want to contextualize where the work is from. So the politics, the conditions of society at the time, where the artists were educated. And so by the time you get to talking about the artwork, it kind of almost becomes a footnote, or in sort of the best case scenario, a symptom of all this context that has been described. So in terms of the structure of the book, it was very important that every chapter really included very, very close readings of the artwork that was being discussed. Because one of the interesting things about Tansequa is that it really wasn't a consolidated movement, in the sense that the artist never banded into an official group. They had no manifesto, no declaration. Yes, they would show together. Yes, they knew of each other. But it was really, it was really in many ways a retroactively applied term to a body of work that happened to emerge at the same time, that also shared lots of the same commitments to process, to the material properties of painting, to this idea of abstraction, to, say, a longer history of Korean modern art that was really based on this almost push and pull tension between what was considered ink painting versus oil painting. So a lot of the challenge of writing this particular book was, one, how is it that one can think about artworks as themselves being able to produce or generate context versus having the context imposed onto the artwork and expecting the artwork to be an allegory of that context?
And you talk early on in the book as well about your choices regarding the narrative structure and the really interesting ways that, in many ways, both the structure of the chapters and the movement from chapter to chapter really gets inside and pulls out from the works themselves, which remain central, a kind of methodology, a conceptual apparatus that we'll talk about later. So there's this idea of points and lines that becomes really, really important to the work of some of the people you're talking about, and also becomes a really important way of structuring the book as a whole. So I thought that was really interesting. Now, the book did start out as a dissertation, or at least this is the first monograph that began some part of its life at the dissertation stage. So can you talk a little bit for us about that transition? Were there any major transformations either in the way you were conceptualizing or in the way you were structuring the project from one stage to the other?
The book has very little resemblance to the dissertation. The dissertation, in many ways, had a very experimental structure. It had only three parts. And the first part was basically an accumulation of close readings of the artworks. The middle part then tried to weave in those close readings and kind of expand, sort of almost like a rhizome, into then thinking about things like politics, society, culture, geography. And then the third chapter then tried to gather all of those different strands together and think about this body of work in relation to its Euro-American counterparts. I think for a dissertation, that kind of structure was fine, simply because, again, you're writing for a very select audience, with 5-6 members of one's dissertation committee. It will that's pretty much how it will end. Of course, with a book, things such as marketing, things such as legibility, things such as how do you make this appeal to a non-specialist audience, these are all concerns that in the end made me really give up that kind of experimental structure and go for of a more conventional, the five chapter format. But the one thing is, I really didn't want to give up was this idea of being able to expand and then focus, because especially a lot of these kinds of monographs that really deal with one particular subject at great depths, is that there's a real sort of temptation to think of it as to parse it into 5 separate case studies without necessarily thinking about the links between those case studies outside of, say, chronological sequence or, say, even thematic concerns. So one of the issues was in transforming this from a dissertation to a book is, well, how does one structure it in such a way that you kind of retain that organic quality without, say, sacrificing the legibility?
Mm-hmm. So. Great. Thank you so much. So this is a great prologue, and let's actually get right into it. With introduction, the urgency of method. Now, you describe early on in the book, I think on the first page, Tansequa as a kind of loose constellation, these are your words, of mostly large abstract paintings done in white, black, brown, and other neutral colors made by Korean artists from the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s. And I mention that just to situate us for listeners who may not be familiar with this body of work. Now, these works were often not called paintings or artworks, but methods. And since method is in the title, this is a running theme throughout the book. Can you talk a little bit about what this means to consider Tansequa as method and the importance of method to it, rather than simply thinking of these pieces as works or as paintings?
Mm-hmm. Of course, the works are also paintings, but the reason why the word method has so much weight in this book is because one thing one sees in the mid-1970s is a real shift from thinking about what is it that artworks mean to how is it that artworks exist. Now, that interest in how has a lot to do with things like process, things like, again, how do materials interact with one another, but it also has to do with this issue of, okay, so these artists are all living in Korea, really just as marginal a place in the international art world as one could possibly get, is that in many ways it's not about what's being produced as how are we going to think about what our larger artistic legacy happens to be. So one of the issues that was very much prioritized at this time was to think less about modernity as something that was necessarily teleological. So it wasn't about advancing towards a goal. It wasn't about innovation. It wasn't about progress. A lot of that refusal to think along those lines also coincide with what at that time was the South Korean state's kind of relentless drive towards progress, towards achievement, towards accomplishing some kind of goal. And a lot of these artists were saying, no, this is not the way to think about what is it that modernity actually entails. It's something that's much more about, well, how do we come to terms with all these different conflicting strands comprise how it is that we think about, say, abstraction or, say, painting.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about the consideration of Tansequa as abstract painting here in this first introductory chapter of the book. And you talk as well about the ways that Korean artists were shaping their work around kind of practices and modes of gestural abstraction that they associated with kinds of work that made up the kind of, or that existed at the kind of international standard of art making. Now, this leads into a discussion of the ways that these artists that you're writing about are contending with, are attending to, the sources and the circulation of information about what was happening in the art world beyond Korea. So what can you talk a little bit about that? What do we need to understand about that before we dive into the numbered chapters of the book? About the ways that early on in the book, Korean artists were attending to the broader circulation of information and how they were getting information about what was happening in the international art world, so that this was then shaping their encounter with gestural abstraction in their work.
So one thing that's kind of interesting about the way in which information was being circulated is it was the fact it was very uneven. So, for example, a lot of the information tended to come in the form of these kinds of grainy black and white photocopies where you couldn't really see the image, but you could read the text. And a lot of these texts are actually coming from, say, Japan or, say, France. The artists that comprised what might be considered, say, the first generation of Tansequa artists were all born during the Japanese colonial period. So all of them had some degree of fluency in Japanese, and they could readily access this text. So what's kind of interesting is this idea that their understanding of all of these different international movements, it's not visually based. It's actually based on these kinds of partial textual descriptions about how big it was, or say what kinds of colors that were used, or what was the impression of the critic that was seeing these kinds of works at that particular time.
Great. Now, as we get further into the chapters, we really get into some of these really wonderfully evocative and gorgeous works that the book is so copiously illustrated with. And so, again, I'll mention for listeners, this is a book where there's a lot of examples of at least reproductions of and images of the work throughout the book, and they act as more than mere illustrations. They really form part of the fabric of the argument. Now, chapter one looks at the way some Tansequa artists use abstraction, and we just talked a little bit about that, as a way to consider larger issues of medium, of materiality, and of the experience and place of the viewer in the work. And we'll see some of these themes recur as well later on in the book. It starts from the 1966 solo exhibition of Kwon Yong-woo, who was an ink painter. Now, being an ink painter in this period, as you talk about in this part of the book, was a matter of contending with a colonial legacy of ink painting that was informing and in some ways pushing against the work of the kinds of ink painters that were coming out of the Tansequa, at least constellation of artists. So can you talk a little bit about that, the sort of the ink painting, and in particular, the ways that this opens up the relationship between these artists, maybe epitomized by Kwon, and the colonial legacy that they are responding to and working within?
Well, the simplest answer to that would be, so the colonial legacy is all, it's all based on a certain structure that's founded on various very sharp divisions. So divisions between what was called Seoyanghwa, or literally Western painting, and Dongyanghwa, Oriental painting, or which included both inkbrush painting and calligraphy, or say between painting and sculpture. Now, these kinds of divisions did not exist before the Japanese occupation, before, say, these kinds of divisions were institutionalized by the system of museums and exhibitions that were initiated by the Japanese. Now, there was, of course, the Korean War. So one thing to just think about is that when people say, or identify post-war art, well, in the Korean context, it really means post-1953. The war that people refer to is the Korean War, not World War II. Now, despite the just massive destruction that was left in the wake of the Korean War, these divisions were still very much intact because as the process of reconstruction occurred, the model, the template on which a lot of this reconstruction took place was basically that left behind by the Japanese. So again, these very sharp divisions between one kind of medium versus another, or one kind of genre versus another, that then spilled over to another division, which started to emerge in the late 1950s, which was abstraction versus figuration. And so one of the things that's interesting about, say, someone like Kwon Young-ho is that he is really coming of professional age amidst all of these negotiations between these divides. So if his work seems a little strange, or actually at that time, very strange, the fact that he's using the paper one normally would use for ink brush painting, but he's not using ink, he's not using water. He's basically breaking that holy trinity that's so inherent into how people are understanding ink painting. What happens is he's trying to think about, well, how do we think about these, how do we think outside of these divisions? Why is it that one has to receive and just accept the structure that has been sort of almost taken for granted? Why can't, say, something that's understood as a painting, which in the Korean context of this particular time meant just sort of a flat surface that one looked at just face on, why can't one think of that as something that's freestanding, as three-dimensional? And this is also an issue that will recur with several other, say, artists associated with Tansequa.
Great. Now, in this really evocative work with paper, where you can really see the concern with and the centrality of the viscerality and the materiality of the paper in Kwon's work, you can really visualize and see the labor coming out of this work and going into this work. Now, in the work of another artist that you talk about in this part of the book, Yoon Hyun-kyun, in the Under Blue series, you mentioned that in that work, you can really see the time, or you can visualize time when you are contending with and encountering the work. So can you talk a little bit about that, the Umber Blue series, and the way that the Umber Blue series asks the viewer to visualize time?
So Yoon is coming from almost sort of the opposite perspective as someone like Kwon. So he's someone that's trained as a Western style oil painter. His father-in-law is kind of one of the godfathers of abstraction in Korea. But all Korean artists, say until about the mid-1960s, were trained in both Western style oil painting and ink painting, regardless of what they ended up majoring in. So one of the things that's noticeable about Yoon's work is the color that he uses. So it's a combination of umber brown and ultramarine blue pigments. And if you mix these together, it forms a very kind of dark layer that looks as if it's black, but in the flesh is actually not. It's just this very kind of rich, extremely dense brown that's produced. Now, what he also did with these two pigments was to add a lot of turpentine. If you add a lot of turpentine to these kinds of pigments, what will happen is that if you apply it to a raw, unprimed canvas, as Yoon does, it will start to separate. So that temporal aspect that you're picking up on or sensing there happens to be this idea of, well, how is it that one can think about the speed at which, say, this paint moves through the canvas, but at the same time, the overall effect isn't necessarily that of speed. It's that of, say, passage. Yeah. So one of the most noticeable parts about each of Yoon Hyun-gun's Umber Blue paintings is the part at which you start to see that separation of the pigment versus its turpentine binder, that kind of a wavery, very jagged sort of line. So the idea of a painting almost existing in stages, almost as if painting is itself something that's necessarily sequential.
Now, this concern with time, with acceleration and rate and pace and speed is also something that comes up in the work of another artist that you explore in the next chapter. And this is Ha Chung-hyun and the Conjunction series. Now, time is really important to this work. And you talk about in this part of the book Ha's work in the context of an awareness of the accelerated pace of the expansion of the Korean art world, the accelerated pace of the circulation of information, and a concern with simultaneity that comes out of this. So can you maybe introduce us briefly to Ha's work in this, specifically in this conjunction series, and sort of lead us from the previous discussion of the importance of time to contend with the importance of time as it's manifest in this work?
So Ha's conjunction series is the earliest incarnations tended to be on this very coarse burlap, and this burlap that wasn't woven very tightly. So what he would do was he would stretch out this canvas over four sort of legs that were essentially taken from a desk. He would stretch canvas over these four legs, and he would reach from behind the canvas and push oil paint up to the front. So again, if one thinks about the temporal dimensions, this idea of, say, adding pressure and then kind of forcing the paint to emerge, say, and kind of rest on top of the surface, that took a long time. So again, to go back to that question of labor that was brought up earlier, I mean, this is something that's really hard work. But while this oil paint was still wet, what he would do was then restretch this canvas on stretcher bars and then mount the canvas upright. So while the oil paint was still wet, it would kind of start to trickle down the front. But it would trickle very slowly, because if you have the kind of oil paint that Ha used, he didn't have that turpentine binder. It was just this really thick kind of white, or occasionally sort of this brownish yellow, sort of almost as if it had the consistency of mud. So one thing that's kind of quite interesting is this almost deliberate, say, or exaggerated slowness, which is very much in marked contrast with everything that was going around him at the time he initiated the series. So Ha Jong-hyun is a little bit different than someone like Kwon Young-woo or Yoon Hyung-gun, both of them who were fairly inactive insofar as organizing exhibitions or being part of the Korean art world scene. I mean, they were kind of reticent, they were kind of remote, kept to themselves a lot. Ha was quite different. So Ha was the first chairman of a group that later proved to be quite influential, called the official name is called the Korean Avant-Garde Artist Association, but everyone called it AG for short. And this group was very much invested in seeking out different kinds of information about overseas artistic developments. They had their own magazine where they would, say, either translate bits taken from, say, foreign magazines, or they would, say, try to come up with their own interpretations of what they thought were important artistic developments. And this actually gets into another interesting question about what are sort of the touchstones for these artists at this time. So a lot of people like to compare Tan Se Kwa to minimalism, because again, there's a, at least from what one sees of the artworks, there's a studied neutrality, there's almost a refusal to elaborate further in terms of you have, say, materials added, but then you have almost this sense of restraint. But the interesting thing is that minimalism never, ever had a real foothold in Korea. It's very, very different from Japan in that respect, where in Japan, by 1970, you have, say, U.S. minimalist artists like Carl Andre being treated like celebrities. There's this wonderful story about Carl Andre going to Tokyo and having people try to stroke his beard, for example. In Korea, none of that. U.S. minimalism, if it was mentioned, it would only be mentioned in the most pejorative of terms. It would be called, say, urban. It would be called citified. It would be called this is the art of a city that has already died. That's a direct quote from one of the more active critics at the time. For a Korean artist, the artists that interested them, very eclectic. Lucio Fontana, for example, or Christo. So artists that were very much involved in actually manipulating materials. So Fontana is an Italian artist known for, say, just really using a knife to kind of cut through canvas. That kind of direct encounter, that was what interested people like Ha Jung-hyun. So when one thinks about this question of, say, acceleration or, say, delay, which is another term I use, it's really about, again, trying to think about how is it that one can think about one's position in this wider international art world? So the other term that you mentioned, simultaneity, is a term that Ha actually uses in talking about the art world in Korea of the 1970s, saying that there are many similarities, there are certainly many parallels, but there's no real sort of convergence, that it's almost as if you have the Korean art world running along one track, but it's not a track that necessarily is beholden to the tracks that have taken place before it, that there is a sense of being in sync with the rest of the world, but not having that being in sync condition determine what's going to happen in the future.
Great. Now, you mentioned the 1970s, and in the 1970s, as you explore in this chapter, Ha was also inspired by and he also engaged with a Japanese group that was very influential among Korean artists at that time, and that was a group called Monoha. Can you maybe just introduce and say a little bit about this group and its importance to Ha for listeners who aren't familiar with it?
So Monoha is a group that's based in Japan, and It was more, say, formalized than Tansequa ever was. Not to the extent of, say, AG. The AG group in Korea had their own magazine. They had regular meetings. They elected their officers. But the Monoha really had a shared sense of purpose. And a lot of that sense of purpose tended to crystallize around the writings of a Korean-born artist named Lee Ufan. So Lee Ufan in 1969 wrote a very, very influential series of essays that later became a book called In Search of Encounter. Now, everything that unified the Monoha artists, it's really this idea, one, the refusal of making. So for them, art making or presenting an artwork was not about asserting one's authorial rights as I am the artist and this is my creation and you as a viewer must be subject to this creation. They were all about refusing that kind of mindset, and instead their works were concerned with how is it that we can bring materials together, different materials or incongruent materials rather, together to form new kinds of juxtapositions that would be based or that would, say, celebrate the experience of the viewer. So in other words, how does one level the otherwise very stratified hierarchy between artist and viewer? So a lot of their works would involve juxtapositions such as iron plates with cotton, for example. Just pairings that you wouldn't normally think about, but pairings that would really kind of shift the burden of figuring out what was going on onto the viewer, rather than having the artist, say, perched from his or her lofty tower and saying, okay, this is what you're going to be looking at. Instead, the Monoha was a group that was really about, okay, this is what we're presenting, but we're not going to tell you what's going on. That's for you to figure out. Yeah. So in terms of the connection between Ha and the Monoha, so Japan was really the entree, really, for Korean artists looking for information or thinking about showing outside of Korea. Again, some of the early precedents for this happened to be art magazines, Japanese art magazines that were smuggled into Korea. So one thing to just think about is the fact that Japanese publications, they're illegal in Korea at this particular time, partly because of, again, the bitterness of Japanese colonial occupation. But by 1965, so by the time that the U.S. basically told Japan, South Korea, okay, you're going to reconcile and reestablish diplomatic relations, even though the two of you hate each other, Japan then becomes a real portal for artists such as Ha Jung-hyun that's looking to show their work to a foreign audience. So the Monoha become, because of their stature in Japan by, say, really by, say, 1969, by 1970, this is really becoming something of a beacon for a lot of artists like Ha Jung-hyun, who are looking at these works and saying, you know what, yeah, we don't have to subject ourselves to the usual, again, divisions between, say, painting or sculpture. We don't have to think about artists as having to perform this obligation of creation. You know, why not put different materials together and see what happens? So, and the fact that the Monoha's main theoretician was Korean, Liu Fan, and that Liu Fan was actually very instrumental in helping so many of these Korean artists show in Japan. That's one of the reasons why it became such a real impetus for Ha and many other artists in Korea at this particular time.
Now, Liu Fan actually forms the focus forms one focus of the next chapter, Encountering Liu Fan in Korea and Japan. You've talked a little bit about him already. One of his works forms the cover of the book. This is a work called From Point from 1973. And this particular work that is shown on the cover of your book is one piece of a larger series of paintings called From Point that coexisted with a series of, or that was, you talk about in the book, conversation with another series of paintings that he did, which is From Line. So From Line, From Point. Now, lines and points, as we briefly talked about a little bit earlier, really form a major conceptual thread throughout the book, and they form a really important way of understanding what he's doing in these works as well. So as an entree into what he's doing in these works, these series From Line and From Point, can you talk about the importance of points and lines as they're informing what he's doing here?
So the point and line are basic units in ink painting. So every painting in, say, the ink painting medium begins with a point, and if you have enough of those points, they will accumulate into a line. Now, a lot of his writings, and this is actually not just exclusive to Liu Fan, but other ink painters have also talked about the importance of these two units, or even perhaps tropes, mainly because for a lot of these artists, the real issue is to think about how do we think about different kinds of scales? And this question of scale becomes very important, say, in this period, so this larger period of the 60s and 70s, where you have, say, Korea kind of being thrown out into this larger international art world, but at the same time, you also have a real kind of sense of loss regarding individual agency. So this is something I'm in some ways anticipating the next chapter, but this is a time when Korea enters into an increasingly dictatorial falls under an increasingly dictatorial rule. So again, this idea of the individual becomes increasingly lost as the state insists upon the construction of this national identity that's supposed to make up for whatever civil liberties are being suppressed in its name. So one of the issues with the point and line, why that surfaces at this time, I think has a lot to do with that sense of scale or sense of trying to reconcile between different scales in which Korean artists are placed. But in formal terms regarding the work itself, one of the other issues is that a lot of these artists are thinking about their works in terms of details. So in other words, it's not the overall image that matters so much as how is it that the accretion of these small details can merge into some kind of whole that doesn't necessarily have to be legible. So again, it's for them, painting is not a product. It's not something that's meant to, it's not something that's a teleological process. It's not supposed to end up in this shiny finished result, but it's rather about sort of the imperfections, about where is it that the painting kind of becomes a little unstable, that it kind of falls apart. So that in each Tansequa work, you'll see a point in which something doesn't seem quite right. So, for example, in Kwon Young-woo's work, so these all-white paintings that it's just ripped paper, the rips aren't terribly even. Or, for example, with Yoon Hyung-gun's Umber Blue paintings, there's a lot of, say, jaggedness that, again, it's him really leaving the work up to chance, that it's him saying, you know, I'm going to relinquish my control, I'm going to relinquish my presumption as the author of the work, and I'm just going to let chance take my place. So there's a lot of, say, irregularity also in the works of Ha Jung-hyun, where, again, he, as he pushes the paint from behind the canvas to the front, that the drips or the marks, they don't seem quite even. And this also holds true with Liu Fan, although to a much lesser degree. And part of that, again, has to do with the fact that Li is actually working from an entirely different set of circumstances than his Korean counterparts. Li is someone who is born in Korea, but he moves to Japan in 1956, and he pretty much stays there consistently throughout. And so the impetuses that inform, say, the From Line and From Point works are a little bit different, which may explain why they do diverge somewhat from other works that have been considered as tansakwa. So, for example, one thing to think about with Liu Fan's works is that he uses mineral pigment. So all those points and lines, it's not made with oil, it's not made with acrylic, it's not made with ink, but it's used. He uses this combination of what's called rock flour. And this is a particular material that is inherent to the medium of Nihonga, or Japanese painting. So this is a medium that it was essentially invented in the late 19th century in Japan as a hybridized sort of medium that involves quote-unquote traditional Japanese brush painting techniques, but also makes use of Western-style perspective and other techniques directly borrowed from Western-style oil painting. Now, the pigment that Liu Fan tends to use in Nihonga proper, artists don't use that much mineral pigment. It's just those colors, those bright colors, just kind of tend to be used as kind of accents or sort of exclamation points almost. But in the From Line and From Point series, he's using it entirely for the execution of the work. So you see these bright blue lines just marked one after the other. Or in other cases, he'll use bright, almost sort of vermilion orange pigment to kind of, and he'll impress the brush so it makes that mark one after the other. So it's a really unorthodox use of materials that, again, does resonate with some of the concerns his Korean counterparts are also dealing with. So the idea that why is it that we have to respect the parameters within which certain kinds of media have always been constructed? Why not think outside those parameters? So in other words, why not take the mineral pigments of Nihonga that usually tend to get reserved for or applied in very small doses, and why not use it as if it was oil? Why not, say, start from a position of abundance rather than scarcity?
Great. Now, one of the other works that really manifests or really embodies his interest in the role and the place of the viewer in the context of the work is this piece that you illustrate in the book called Things and Words. And briefly put, they come in the form of these really large sheets of paper among other elements of the work. And it's really, really striking. And I just want to kind of mark that for listeners. So it's really, you can find a discussion of this fascinating work in this chapter. This is Things and Words, the title. It's inspired, as you describe so wonderfully in this chapter of the book, by the work of Foucault. So there's a really interesting engagement with that kind of theoretical background as well. Now, this work really emphasizes his interest, as at least as you present it in this chapter, in the place of the viewer. And this is also an interest shared by his close friend, whose work makes up a centerpiece of the next chapter. This is Park Seo-bo. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Park Seo-bo, yes.
Park Seo-bo, okay. So Park Seo-bo is also interested in his work in the viewer's relationship to the artwork. And one of the series that he does is described by a critic that you quote in the chapter as being one of the three most important works of Korean art since independence from Japan. Can you introduce us a little bit to his work and perhaps the importance of the his conception of the viewer's relationship to the artwork as it manifests therein?
So Park Seo-bo is... quite unlike, he's more in the vein of, say, Ha Jong-hyun in the sense that he's sort of the godfather of the Korean art world. He's the one who gets Liu Fan his first real break in Korea when he and Lee first meet in the late 1960s in Tokyo. This is an artist who is probably more invested in trying to promote Korean contemporary art overseas than any other artist in at least in the first few decades of post-war Korean art. And so for him, it was very, very important to think about, what is it exactly that Korean art sort of brings to the table? Now, the work that he produces is a series of paintings, oil paintings, that's originally called myobo. And in Korean, literally that means law of depiction. And what these paintings entail are they're large canvases that have been covered with layers of usually very sort of creamy, yellowish, sometimes grayish paint. And while the paint is still drying, he'll go over each canvas with usually a very sort of blunt-tipped graphite pencil, something that's very, very thick. And he'll just make these sort of wave-like marks or sort of these curlicues, very early versions. The marks tended to be very tentative, almost like as if there were just these very delicate tally marks. But the end result of all of these works is really an experience of illegibility. They're very, very hard to reproduce properly. So one thing that is very noticeable in the book is that they almost look kind of washed out. Mm-hmm. And part of that, again, has to do with the fact that, again, there's limitations to reproduction, but that's also how they look like in certain kinds of lighting situations. So one thing that Park Seo-bo, again, this is someone who's very savvy about the way his works are presented, is that he knows that if you see these works, which they're not stark white either, so they don't kind of pop out at the viewer, they sort of blend in into the wall. And if you're seeing it in, say, conventional gallery conditions where the light is overhead, the marks will kind of almost disappear, almost seem to disseminate into the canvas, but you can still sense that there's been a disruption of some kind, that that sort of smoothness, the consistency one might expect with this color of paint has been disturbed. And the original installation of these works in 1973 actually had Park sort of suspending the canvas from the wall itself. So he would leave about a 10-centimeter distance between the wall and the back of the canvas. So you had a real sense of its own, kind of its objecthood. So this idea that, again, relating this back to the question of viewer experience, is that this way of installation is a way for Park to say, you know, this is not just, again, a flat surface. Don't read it as if it was a mirror image of the wall. Read it also as an object having its own sense of or own capacity of or own, how should I put it, way of commanding space. That this is, again, not something that should be just read as pure image, but we also have to read this as an object, as itself having some kind of a concrete presence as well.
Now, he's also involved in something called something translated as the National Documentary Paintings Project. And you reproduce an image of this work that he made for this project called Export Frigate. It's really, really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about this project and perhaps as a way of opening up the larger political frame within which he's working?
So the National Documentary Paintings Project was and probably still is the single largest visual arts project ever undertaken by the South Korean government. It begins in 1966, and it consists of commissioning artists, almost exclusively oil painters, with the task of commemorating various historical, military, and later economic triumphs of the South Korean state. And Park Seo-bo, because again, he's one of sort of the doyens of the post-war Korean art world, gets tapped to do this project. Now, in Korean art history, participation in this project has almost been considered as a mark of complicity with the authoritarian state. But most of the artists that were involved in this project, they did so really for out of practical reasons. If you participated, you got paid a handsome sum, you got access to what at that time were very expensive canvases and oil paints. It was a pretty good deal, in other words. So one sort of issue that this fourth chapter tried to deal with is to really think about that sort of binary of complicity and resistance in much more nuanced terms. Because if you see the work that Paxovo actually did for the National Documentary Paintings Project, there is no question that complicity is not an accurate term to describe his attitude, because the painting is painted in, it's one of the weirdest paintings, at least my colleagues have told me, that they've ever seen. It looks like a conventional scene of a big export ship, but everything is so spelled out so literally that one starts to think of, to what extent is this work a kind of send-up of the attempt of the state to kind of spoon-feed its viewers what it is they want them to believe? So, for example, the word export is spelled out, that each person on the dock is given his or her own space, that boxes that ostensibly contain goods for export, they're repeated over and over again to the point where you want to say, you know, stop, okay, we get the point. You know, it's about export. Yeah, let's move on. One of the oddest things about this work is the size. So there are two figures in the foreground, and they're exactly the proportions of an adult viewer who would have been looking at this. So again, one of the questions that Pak then opens up is, well, to what extent, again, are we as viewers, how do we figure into this landscape that the state wants us to believe in? How is it that, what is sort of our role? And he's never very clear about that. And I think that ambiguity is one way to think in more complex terms about this issue of resistance versus complicity that is so very much a part of how this particular period tends to be historicized.
Now, as we move into the last two chapters of the book, we move into a chapter on Tan Sze Kwa and the idealization of Asian art, and this is chapter 5. Some of these works were exhibited overseas, and what this chapter does is it looks at how these works become folded into a larger project to promote the idea of an Asian contemporary art. You talk about, the political framing within which this is happening in Korea. Now, the history of what would later be called contemporary Asian art, as you say in this part of the book, can actually be traced to the emergence of a rhetoric of Tan Sze Kwa in Japan, France, and Korea in the late 1970s. One of the really interesting set pieces that comes out of this chapter is something called Five Korean Artists, Five Kinds of White. And you talk about the importance and the connotations of white, not just in the way works of Korean artists are understood and conceptualized, but also how this becomes kind of a trope of contention. So maybe can you open up this particular chapter and what you take to be the most important things happening in this chapter by starting us off by talking about this notion of white and what kind of work it's doing here?
So the exhibition you mentioned, Five Korean Artists, Five Kinds of White, it's often taken to be the starting point of Tan Sze Kwa. But it's interesting that it takes place at a gallery whose owner, a man named Yamamoto Takashi, the founder of the Tokyo Gallery, he's a person who's making his money primarily from selling antiques. And the catalog that accompanies this show really stresses a resemblance between Joseon Dynasty white porcelain and the common use of white by the five artists selected to show work, even though the white that they use are all very different. So, for example, the white of the paper that Kwan uses, one can't really compare that to the sort of creamy yellowness of the quasi-white that, say, someone like Pak Sobo uses. And the sort of an issue for Tan Sze Kwa is that in likening the surfaces to Joseon Dynasty porcelain, those who are responsible for organizing the show were attempting to establish these works as a worthy successor to traditional Korean art on the one hand, which in turn was part of a larger project in Japan to establish what an ideal contemporary Asian art might look like in contradistinction to the West. So it's a very deeply, it's a very problematic situation, also given the provenance, because a lot of viewers would have linked that idea of the whiteness of the, these paintings to the observations of Yanagi Muneyoshi, the legendary Japanese connoisseur, who in 1922 described Korea as Korean art as being about the beauty of sorrow. And that's an observation he supported by pointing to how Koreans at that time wore white, which is a traditional funereal color in Asia. And so for someone like Yanagi, this practice indicated a race that was perpetually in mourning. Now, Yanagi, of course, he died in 1961, but his writings and that description had been translated into Korean in 1974, so 1 year before the Five Korean Artists, Five Kinds of White show, and it was followed by scathing criticism by Korean critics, again, who are very much upset about these sorts of characterizations, not so much of what they implied, but the fact that why is it that we're letting this guy, who again died decades ago, why is it that he's speaking for the entirety of Korean art? Where's our agency in all of this? But another thing to also think about is that not only this particular show, but other examples of tansakwa were shown in first in commercial galleries, which were in Tokyo. So in, say, framing them as exemplars of white, as the following up on the inheritance of Joseon white porcelain, one also has to think about the extent to which critics were trying to make these works understandable to an audience in Tokyo that's accustomed to thinking about paintings as goods, as commodities, and as goods that were offered to a distinctly bourgeois audience. There was no market for these works in Korea at that time. So that's also something else to think about. Now, one thing that is quite interesting about tansakwa painting is that they're really about, say, inverting, say, this kind of situation. So in other words, about saying that the production of painting was secondary, was no longer secondary to the means. And I think this is eventually what starts to really come to a head with the various classifications to which tansakwa has been kind of associated with, the idea that it's natural, the idea that it's, say, traditional looking, that actually looking at these works of the flesh really just butt heads with the way in which it's been classified. And I think the strongest tansakwa works are those that really kind of were able to fight against the rhetoric to which it's been it's often been sort of associated with. I mean, I don't think there's a single tansakwa artist who is immune to the rhetoric, but there are certainly a lot of works where even artists as deeply invested in promoting it, such as Park Seo-bo, were able not to have rhetoric decide how the painting should look or how it should be made. But I do think it became harder over time because this rhetoric hardened into its own self-fulfilling consensus, and partially that had to do with the force of its detractors, most notably the critics involved with the Minju movement that became very, very influential in South Korea in the 1980s.
And the epilogue actually talks a little bit about the Minjung movement and the emergence of a kind of contextualism after its ascent. The epilogue also looks at the idea of a global art world, rather from the perspective of the reception of tansakwa art in the 1980s and after. And you look into the 1980s as a turbulent political time and the way this is informing what's happening, and also into the global turn of contemporary art and the relaxing of restrictions on overseas travel by South Koreans in the 1990s. Now, among the many really fascinating things happening in this epilogue is the introduction of the work of some really fascinating artists. So I'd love to talk about all of them, but I don't want to again keep you for another hour. So I'll just bring up the work of an artist, Kim Suja, whose work features really vibrantly, brightly colored fabric and is actually really quite different from the kind of work that we see earlier in the book. So could you maybe kind of bring us to the conclusion of the book, rather the epilogue of the book and the conclusion of our discussion about it, by talking a little bit about Kim Suja and the kinds of artists that are emerging in this last stage, and what do we need to understand about this work to understand the larger transformations that you're recounting here in this last part of the book?
So Kim Soo-ja is actually a student of Park Seo-bo's. Today, she's probably one of the five most best-known contemporary Korean artists today, working internationally. She represented Korea at the Venice Biennial, and she's mostly known for works in which that involve the wrapping of cloths. And one wouldn't normally associate the wrapping of cloths with, say, abstract painting. But one link that I really tried to emphasize is this idea of, again, how is it that someone like Kim Soo-ja is taking this Tan Seok-hwa's emphasis on materiality, on, say, how is it that materials engage with one another, and being able to resituate that using different materials, or in this case, fabric. So, for example, she engages with a lot of folding. She's very attentive to surfaces. And I don't think that these issues are, say, completely alien to what it is that she had been exposed to in an earlier period. But one thing about, say, Tan Seok-hwa there are three sort of main kind of takeaways in terms of Tan Seok-hwa's legacy. One, and most importantly, again, is this issue of, well, how do things come to be? So the idea that one can't take the painting or abstraction or, say, medium for granted. A lot of Tan Seok-hwa's works are very introspective in terms of, it's really about taking apart sort of the basic assumptions as to, well, how do we come to this point? You know, what actually goes into a painting? Is it just paint slapped on a canvas? Or how is it that the canvas can be made to behave in a different way? The second takeaway is that Tan Seok-hwa really is the first major face of contemporary Korean art after the Korean War. It's the first movement to be promoted overseas. And in many ways, it sets the tone for how later artists, say, enter into the conversation, or in many cases, refuse to enter into the conversation. So there are a lot of, say, other artists in Korea that don't want to be considered contemporary Korean at all, in part because of the extent to which the Tan Seok-hwa rhetoric has, say, privileged cultural difference as the primary index by which one is getting into the work. And that's kind of a contradiction to what the Tan Seok-hwa works actually were, because the works are not about cultural difference at all. In fact, it's really about viewer accessibility. But the rhetoric that was used to promote Tan Seok-hwa, it really turned off an entire generation of artists who are saying, you know, I don't want to be known as some person who makes natural Korean-looking exotica for Western or Japanese consumption. I want my works to be considered as independent and autonomous of that. So that's also sort of another interesting thread. The third takeaway is the question of how is it that one is going to position oneself in an exhibition? So this is a movement that was promoted through the vehicle of the exhibition, which is, of course, very different than what had taken place, say, before the emergence of Tan Seok-hwa. So you had all these big group shows, and the way in which these works were arranged, this was something that became very important to not only to Tan Seok-hwa artists, but to artists who are coming in their wake. It becomes increasingly more important, say, after the 1990s, when the idea of a non-Western modern art started to gain a little bit of momentum, say, in the West.
Great. Now, earlier on when we were talking, you mentioned that the book has actually created a market for post-war Korean art. So as we come to our conclusion, can you talk a little bit about what's happened since your book has been published and some of these broader ramifications that you've seen?
I think to actually say that the book created a market, it may be a slight exaggeration, but I am pleased that it has contributed to a greater awareness of Tan Seok-hwa. So the book came out in the summer of 2013, and very soon after, I'd been approached by a Los Angeles gallery called Blum & Poe, which is perhaps best known for their very successful promotion of Monoha, and perhaps even more for their championing of Takashi Murakami and Yoshitomo Nara, probably the world's best known contemporary Japanese artists. And they had approached me to do a show in their LA space. Now, at that time, there was another gallery. So Korea's flagship gallery, Kukje Gallery, was also planning their show. And they decided to move the timing of their show to practically coincide with the timing of the show in LA. And so what that happened was it really kind of sparked a lot of interest in Tansukwa as it both in Korea, but also outside of Korea as well. So one thing that happened was a lot of institutional interest. So interest expressed by museums that were not in Korea. And this is something that's really unprecedented in the history of not only Tansukwa, but post-war Korean art, that people are looking taking the time to re-examine a period that really, for most of its history, was completely neglected. So this is something for me that I feel very proud of, to have contributed to this re-examination of this particular time.
So Joan, thank you so much for donating so much of your time to talk about the book. Now, there's so much going on in the book that we didn't have a chance to talk about. It's an extraordinarily, really wonderfully rich study. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
One of the things I'd like to just mention very briefly is that this book it's not written for, say, a Koreanist audience. This is a book that its primary audience is my home discipline, art history. But its primary discipline is really for anyone that's invested in thinking and looking closely at objects per se. So I think one of the real issues in, say, expanding the field of post-war Korean art is to have histories of art that really look outside its kind of its own immediate perimeters to engage, say, specialists working in other fields. So in other words, when I was writing this book, the question I had was, well, why would, say, I don't know, a historian of Latin American modern art be interested? What is it that this work has, how does this work, say, resonate with its counterparts in other, being made in other times, but which could possibly share similar commitments or similar interests? And I think this is a really kind of critical next step, not just for post-war Korean art history, but also post-war Asian art history in general, is to really think beyond the regional framework. How is it that one is going to be able to, again, pay a close enough attention to the object that the object kind of becomes its own entity that's greater than sort of the sum of its contextual forces?
And now that the book is out, and again, congratulations on a very beautiful book, what's next for you? What project or projects are currently inspiring you?
So I'm actually in London because I'm doing a visiting fellowship at the Tate Museum, which has an Asia-Pacific Research Center. And so in December, I'm giving a talk on performance in Yushin, Korea. So the turn towards why is it that so many artists also think about performance-based artworks as a way in which to negotiate some of the travails of everyday life in perhaps Korea's most darkest time. So this is a time when all kinds of civil liberties were repressed. Outright protest was something that was very brutally suppressed. So what is it about, say, gesture and certain engagements with the body that allow these artists to think otherwise about this very, very difficult period?
Well, thanks so much. Thanks again for making the time to talk. And it's really been a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us. And we'll see you next time.